Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and earned a BS degree in basic sciences from the U.S. Air Force Academy and a doctorate in planetary sciences from the University of Arizona. After flying B-52 strategic bombers for 7 years, he became an astronaut and flew on 4 space shuttle missions and led 3 spacewalks to install the centerpiece of the International Space Station, the American Destiny Laboratory. The author of 7 books is named Dr. Tom Jones. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Dr. Tom Jones. From 1991 to 2001, he was an astronaut and flew 4 missions totaling 53 days. Doctor, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. A pleasure.
Can you start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, all the way till I went to college in a small town on the east side of the city called Essex. And that's where my father had gotten a job in the early 1950s as a school teacher. And of course, my mom came along with him when he got that new job right out of college. So they were residents of this little town of Essex, Maryland. And he was a school teacher, then later a guidance counselor. My mom worked as a lab technician. And then when she had all 4 of her kids, it was just too much of a handful. So she was just a homemaker after that. And I had a wonderful childhood growing up. I had my dad home every day at about 4:30 in the afternoon from school. And we had nice long summer vacations. Just great parents, always encouraged my dreams and never laughed at me for expressing them.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, Tom? And what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Well, my dad always taught me to live up to our faith and our family ideals. And, you know, we were strong Catholics and lived right next door to the churchyard and went to elementary school at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Elementary School. So he and my mom both endorsed, you know, our Catholic upbringing. We were very regular attendees at church, and I was in the altar boys and the church choir and so forth. So he was a steady hand in terms of moral upbringing. And my mom was just very loving. You know, she always forgave whatever screw-ups that we discovered we could do and found ourselves in. And so they were very forgiving parents, even if they did emphasize that, you know, you had to follow the rules. And we got punished, but my 2 brothers and my sister and I always knew that we'd be forgiven.
How did you ever get interested in aviation and astronomy?
Where I lived was right next door to an airfield. And the Martin Company, which later became Martin Marietta, and then later Lockheed Martin. The Martin Company had a World War II huge aircraft factory there. By the time I was growing up there in the late 50s, they were still flying a lot of airplanes at the Air Guard base at the airport. And Martin was still making seaplanes for the Navy. So overhead, there were just aircraft of every type going back and forth all the time, roaring and jets and propellers. And it was always fascinating to me as a young kid to look up in the sky. And then later, when I was 6, 7 years old, we got into the space race with the Russians. And Martin was right at the center of that. They were building rockets to take the Gemini astronauts into space. And so I soon became a really big fan, almost a geek about the space race and space exploration. So that's how I got my start.
America is a beautiful country, and one of the greatest places is Colorado Springs. And from 1974 to 77, you were blessed to attend the Air Force Academy. Phenomenal. Talk about those college years.
I was really lucky to get an appointment to the Air Force Academy, and thank all of you for sending me there, of course, on the taxpayer's nickel. But I did serve after I graduated for 6 years, and I tried to pay some of that faith in me back. So my years at the Air Force Academy were ones of great opportunity. I met many friends that became lifelong companions and colleagues of mine, both pilots that I flew with and classmates who I still stay in touch with. So that was wonderful. And then there were opportunities at that college that no other ordinary college could offer. So I learned to fly. I got to jump out of an airplane with a parachute. I learned from rocket and aircraft design experts at the Academy. I met Wernher von Braun and a couple of Apollo moonwalkers. And so all of the pursuits that I saw for myself, my career path, I could learn about and talk to people who had actually lived that path. And so that was just a great opportunity. And I went out from the Air Force Academy ready to get into this path of joining the space program somehow, some way.
It's right at the base of the Colorado Rockies. Describe for us that cathedral, that church on campus.
Yeah, the chapel was a wonderful architectural monument. Huge soaring steel spires lifting towards the heavens. And I spent very many hours at the Academy Chapel, the Catholic Chapel there. I was a member of the Cadet Catholic Choir. So we regularly sang at Mass on Sundays. We had choir trips around the country that the Air Force helped sponsor, and we were hosted by churches around the country. So it was a great place to make friends. It was a great place to get support. You know, the Air Force Academy is not an easy society or life. At the time I attended, only 1 year did we have women attending the Academy. The other 3 years it was an all-male school. It was very lonely there, strict discipline at first, and a lot of homesickness. And you could always go to the chapel and get your needs met and get a buck up from one of the Catholic chaplains or any of the chaplains for that matter.
You mentioned that you served for 6 years and you flew B-52 strategic bombers over 2,000 hours worth. Talk about that chapter of your life.
My goal was to become an astronaut. And so the Air Force offered me the chance to become a pilot. And then I hoped I would become a test pilot, you know, an expert professional aviator. And then that would give me the chance to get hired by NASA into the astronaut corps. And so I really was following the moon landings, and I went to the Academy shortly thereafter. NASA was starting to build the space shuttle, so I really wanted to be a part of that program. So my path was to become a pilot. So I went to pilot training after graduation as a lieutenant in Oklahoma, learned to fly jets, and then the Air Force gave me not my dream assignment, which was to be an F-15 Eagle fighter pilot, but they gave me an assignment to the B-52 bomber, which was an airplane that first flew in 1952. So it was already 25 years old by the time I got assigned to it. And I thought, well, that's the death of my space aspirations, because the bomber was not the fastest thing around. It was not maneuverable. It was an old airplane. And yet, flying the B-52 in Strategic Air Command during the Cold War, you know, we had a very important nuclear deterrence mission. We practiced for all kinds of interesting combat scenarios. And it was a demanding flying machine that, in order for you to be good at it, you had to really work at mastering the B-52. It really offered a pilot rewards in showing your skills and learning new skills, to fly behind an aerial tanker and refuel in the stratosphere, and to fly low level and deliver bombs. And I never flew in combat. Nobody ever shot at me, but I learned to be a very good professional pilot working with the five other crew members on my bomber crew. And so I learned to work with other professionals. I learned how to follow and then lead in another dimension up from Boy Scouts and up from the Air Force Academy. And so here I was doing those same leadership and following lessons in the air. And I came away from the B-52 with the skills to be a very professional member of an aerospace team.
We're talking to astronaut Tom Jones. And in January of 1990, he was selected by NASA to become an astronaut. We'll talk to him about that when we come back. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with astronaut Tom Jones. Tom, they selected you in January of 1990, and then you became an astronaut. In July of 91, you were part of the 13th group of astronauts. Talk about what it means to be an astronaut.
To me, becoming an astronaut meant the achievement of a lifelong dream. You know, I was hired by NASA when I was 35 years old, and I'd been dreaming then for 25 years of becoming a spaceman someday. So I really wanted to be part of the NASA team, push the boundaries of our knowledge out into the solar system and beyond, and to expand the human presence to not only the moon, where we'd been just a few years earlier, but also to new worlds out there like the asteroids and Mars eventually. So I really thought I would be part of that expansion of humanity into space. And that's what motivated me. And it was very competitive to get hired by NASA. You know, in order to get hired, you know, I was a pilot in the Air Force, but that's just not good enough. There are so many applicants. There were 3,000 the year that I applied, and they were people with master's degrees and medical degrees and so forth. So long before I applied successfully, I had to go out and get a PhD in planetary science from the University of Arizona and add that to my flying credentials. And then I had a chance of being competitive there. So it's a really a tough crowd to win out in the middle of. And, you know, I interviewed with 120 people during a week at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, all kinds of medical exams and a psychological battery of tests. And then you're evaluated against your peers. You get an interview with the astronaut selection panel, and you hope that they will decide that you are someone that they would like to work with. And I failed twice. I was rejected twice. And then the third time I was hired in 1990. So it meant to me that now I was on at least the threshold of living that dream. Yeah, I had a job title that said astronaut, but I hadn't done anything yet. And I had to learn through at least a year of basic astronaut school to get qualified for a space shuttle flight. So I had a long road ahead of me, but at least I was given a chance.
Let's go back 51 years, July 20th, 1969. Neil Armstrong famously says, "One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins. Talk to us about the enormity of that achievement with the technology that they had at the time, Tom.
Well, that was the culmination of a Cold War race with the Soviets, the Russians, to see who could put a man on the moon and return him safely. And there was no doubt that it was a Cold War struggle. We didn't want to fire at each other or, you know, get into a nuclear confrontation. So competing in space was a peaceful way to do that. But the stakes were every bit as high, because whoever was the technical master of space would be perceived by other nations around the world as the most advanced technical power on Earth and the one that they should throw their lot in with. And so that's why it was important. So the country really put a high priority on that. We spent about 4.5% of the federal budget for close to 10 years to achieve that goal, almost on a wartime scheduling and budgetary footing. So it was an amazing technical feat. It's almost as if we took a decade out of the 21st century and stuck it back in the 1960s so we could bring all that brain power and technology to bear. It was because of President Kennedy's commitment to achieve that moon landing that the nation was able to achieve that goal. And we haven't had that kind of commitment from a leader ever since then. I think that's one of the reasons we haven't progressed as fast in space. So when Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins succeeded in putting their boot prints on the moon and Mike brought them back from lunar orbit, that was not only the achievement of a technical goal, but it also showed that the country, when challenged, could do its very best and could bring forth all of its talent to achieve a goal. And that's a lesson we shouldn't forget.
We're talking to astronaut Tom Jones. If you want to learn more, www.astronauttomjones.com. He went up four times. Tom, share with us what a launch is like.
A launch on the space shuttle was probably the most thrilling physical and mental exhilarating experience that any human could imagine. You're not only invested in doing a great job up there, but this is your first chance to get to space and experience it for yourself. And even though you've been told about it, you've ridden the simulator countless times, there's nothing like being on a real rocket on the launch pad. And so for me, all of my senses were tuned to try to soak up this experience. And so at 6 seconds before liftoff, the main fuel valves opened, the main engines began to ignite, and there was a rumble down from the rocket beneath us as if you were on a skyscraper in an earthquake. And the entire machine, 225 feet tall, starts shaking and vibrating, and the roar comes up from the engines. When they get up to full thrust, after 6 seconds, you're at zero in the countdown. And if the computers like what they see, they ignite the solid rocket boosters strapped to the sides of the fuel tank on the shuttle. And there's the tremendous bang. And now 80% of the thrust of the shuttle is added to that equation, that fight against gravity. And there's a huge kick in your back as you lie on your seat, and you're thrust upward as if somebody has kicked your chair halfway to the ceiling. And the shaking and the rattling is like going down a dirt road in a pickup truck at about 50 miles an hour. And you're just conscious of the power of this 4.5 million pound machine being thrown into the air towards space with 7 million pounds of rocket thrust. And it's a controlled explosion. And you're at the very tip of a machine that's unleashing this chemical power into those rocket engines. And all you can do is hope that all the technology hangs in there, that everything has been checked out and thoroughly prepared by the ground crews. And now this machine will take you on the ride of your life.
You get up 220 miles, four shuttle missions. You spent 53 days up there. And each day, Doctor, you saw 16 sunrises. So I believe, if my math is right, 16 times 53 days is 848 sunrises. Does it ever get old?
It does not ever get boring or old. Every time you look out the window, the Earth is different. Every sunset is different. Every sunrise is different. And every experience up there adds to the enjoyment of working in space. It's a hard job. The 53 days up there, I've worked harder than any other time of my life. You work flat out for close to 16 hours a day. And at the end of a 2 or 3 week mission, you're ready to come back and have a vacation. Of course, on the space station today, when you're up there for 6 months, the schedule backs off a little bit and it's more like 10 hours a day and you get half a day off on Saturday and Sunday is a day off. But on space shuttle missions, it's a flat out sprint. So it never gets old. It's always very challenging. You are a representative of the United States working with your teammates up there in orbit, maybe working with some international partners on board, and you can't make a mistake. The expectation is that you will do a perfect job and execute all the jobs and tasks that have been laid out before you. So you get the benefit from that space mission that the taxpayers have trained you to do. And so the pressure is on. And to me, it's the only thing that came close would be like taking college final exams every day for 2 weeks in a row. And by the end of every day in orbit, my brain was fried and looking out the window was the best antidote for that kind of pressure.
Four shuttle missions, the first one, STS-59 in April of 94, STS-68, October of 94, STS-80 in late 96. And then let's go to the fourth one, STS-98, February of 2001. Talk about that mission, please.
Well, the three science missions I flew first were good training for all of the things that you could do on a space shuttle. And then on the final flight on STS-98 on Atlantis, we went to the space station and did everything that a space shuttle crew and its machine could do. We did rendezvous, and we did docking, and we did spacewalks, and we used the robot arm to take the laboratory that we lofted to Earth orbit out of the cargo bay and plug it into the space station where it's still the centerpiece of activity there today. And then my partner, Bob Kerbeam, and I were lucky enough to go outside for a total of 19 hours and help install and activate that Destiny Science Lab. So we ran through everything that you could do on the space shuttle. That's the machine that's so versatile that even 9 years after, 10 years after it's retired, no one has duplicated what the space shuttle can do. So that mission was completely in line with the preparation I'd had on those other flights. You do certain jobs on one flight, you do a different set of tasks on a different flight. And by the time I flew this fourth mission, they asked you to do everything that you'd learned so far. And so did my teammates. So we had a crew of five plus the three on the space station. And that team of eight people, we worked very diligently for a week together to activate that new science lab, which has been humming ever since. In fact, it's been up there now for almost exactly 20 years.
You're being somewhat modest. That laboratory was the size of a school bus. It weighed 30,000 pounds, and it cost $1.4 billion with a B dollars. When we come back, we're going to ask them about that job of launching that laboratory. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with astronaut Tom Jones. All right, the eight of you have to get this laboratory the size of a school bus weighing 30,000 pounds and costing $1.4 billion from Atlantis into the space station. How'd you do it?
Teamwork is the answer. And everybody who flies a space shuttle mission will tell you that same answer. It's only possible with teamwork. When you think about your limited abilities, doing it by yourself, you'd have no chance of success. And it truly is amazing when you team up a shuttle crew, a space station crew, and mission control in Houston and Moscow, and all of those people working together like a synchronized watch. It really is amazing what you can pull off. It's astonishing, truly, that at the end of the process, you go, holy smokes, we actually got that $1.4 billion lab installed. So it was in the cargo bay of Atlantis, this big school bus-sized lab, and Marsha Ivins had to use the robot arm and reach out and lift up the 16-ton laboratory out of the cargo bay, and very precisely, with a tolerance of only an inch or so, swing this big bus-sized laboratory up against its docking port. And once she did that precision berthing operation, you know, then the rest of the crew were actually issuing computer commands to lock the laboratory permanently to the rest of the space station. And then outside, my friend Bob and I had to, at the exact right moment, had to start plugging in cables that would power up the lab from the solar panels and batteries on the station over to the laboratory itself. Power cables, cooling lines to keep the interior of the laboratory at a comfortable temperature for the science and for the people inside, and computer data cables and so on. And we attached a lot of equipment to the outside of the lab for future expansion of the space station. So it's all choreographed, and it took a role by every member of that team, both the people on the space station, the people on the shuttle. We actually had the doors shut between the two vehicles, so we couldn't actually toss stuff back and forth or even talk to each other very easily. So it all been choreographed and practiced, and then we worked through this installation and activation of the lab over these three spacewalks. So it was an astonishing experience to be your own little spaceship outside and then doing the work of ignoring the tremendous views out your spacesuit helmet while focusing on trying to get this laboratory activated. And we ran into some snags that had to be overcome. For example, one of our cooling lines sprang a leak, sticky valve that stuck partially open, and it was venting the precious coolant out of the laboratory. And yet my partner, Bob Kerbeam, didn't lose his cool. And because of his skill and his coolness under pressure, he was able to bypass the leaky valve, shut off the flow, save the vital cooling system, and then we worked together with Mission Control to get the line installed successfully. So it took that kind of quick reaction under pressure. It took the teamwork from the ground helping us to achieve success. And it really was amazing to bring all of that together and to see it succeed.
We're talking astronaut Tom Jones. Those three spacewalks comprised a total of 19 plus hours. All right, you're out there for 19 hours. 220 miles above the Earth. What was the most amazing Earth view you saw in those 19 hours?
First of all, Jack, you have to think that when you're working out there, usually your face is full of the laboratory or the rest of the space station or a piece of the space shuttle. So typically you're not looking at the Earth. You're focused on what your hands are doing in front of you, just a foot or so away. So it's difficult to get a good Earth view. And in fact, in those 19 hours, I was well towards the end of those on my third spacewalk when I got ahead of schedule a little bit. Both Bob and I had succeeded in getting our jobs done a little bit more quickly on that mission, on that spacewalk. And I actually asked Houston, I said, can I have 5 minutes out here just to float and enjoy? And they said, sure, you're ahead of schedule. Before you leave that spot, why don't you just hang out and relax? And so I just hung on by my fingertips to the very front end of the space station. And I was able to rotate my whole spacesuit, my whole body around almost a 360 degree arc. And you could see out in front of you the horizon 1,000 miles away with those beautiful sunrises and sunsets, black sky up above, and the golden solar panels of the space station up above you, like the sails of a sailing ship silently cruising around the planet. And if I look down past my boots, I could see 220 miles straight down to the blue of the Pacific Ocean. And you see that kind of a scene of the cosmos and our home planet, and tears come to your eyes with the beauty of that scene, that you're able to actually soak that in and perceive what's out there. It was just a tremendous privilege to see that view and then to realize that it was a gift personally made to you by God.
Speaking of which, our great mutual friend, Colonel Jack Lausma, described that it's God's great cathedral in the sky. And I quote you now, space was a spiritual experience. You have a very strong faith. Talk about what you talked to God about while we were up there for 53 days.
I was often able to ask for help because when I was at the limit of what I could do personally, whether it was physical stamina on a spacewalk or whether it was just keeping my brain focused to make no mistakes during a job up there, you know, you just ask for help. And you say, you've given me, Lord, all these talents. You've given me these skills over the years of growing up and working. You know, how can I apply these to best effect? Help me do the best with the skills and the gifts that you've given me. So, you know, you also pray for physical safety. You know, you recognize the risks involved in the job. So you say, just bring me through this and bring me home safely. And at the same time, you're asking for your physical health and survival, if you will. you're asking the Lord to watch out for your family. You know, if that's not the plan and you're not going to make it back, please take care of my family. So those are the kinds of things that you would ask for. And then occasionally, like at the end of that third spacewalk, when you saw the magnificence of the universe out there laid out in front of you, you just say, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Your first mission in 1984, there were six astronauts on board. Three of you were Catholic. And on the Sunday after Easter, you had communion up there. What was that like?
We were very fortunate that among the six astronauts, three of us were Catholic, and we had the foresight, thanks to Kevin Chilton, our co-pilot, to bring the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist, up with us to share communion in space. And then we were very fortunate that the mission was going so well that a good 8 days into the mission, we finally had time on a Sunday to gather together between a shift change, if you will, and to take about 10 minutes to just have a little prayer service on board. And we invited the rest of the crew, but the three of us, of course, had this special link. We'd been parishioners together back in Houston, and we were able to share communion up there. And that was a chance to realize God's presence immediately, physically, right with us in the spacecraft, the Space Shuttle Endeavor. And we really felt his companionship, his friendship, his guidance, his protection, even as we were able to gaze out the window at the universe that he had created. So it was truly an inspiring moment and a way for us to thank him together. Just, you know, there's that gospel saying about whenever two or more of you are gathered in my name, I'll be there with you. And that's what we felt aboard the Endeavor that day.
We're talking to astronaut Tom Jones. If you want to learn more at www.astronauttomjones.com. Tom, many scientists and geniuses don't believe in a God. Why are you so sure there is a God?
I could say that it's part personal experience from having been in space, but you know, we don't have to be a spaceman to know that there's a God out there. When we look at the complexity of the universe, and as a planetary scientist, I've studied the solar system. My favorite topic is asteroids and comets, and they're just parts of this tremendous complexity that it's our solar system, our sun's family of planets, and that we're just one of over 100 billion planets in our Milky Way galaxy. And when you look at the hundreds of billions of galaxies that are out there, to me, it's just beyond comprehension that all of this could have happened randomly in our current universe. So I believe that it took a creator to manifest the universe that we see today. And if somebody is so powerful and all knowing that they can create the universe that we exist in, I expect that he's also got the talents to help us out individually when we ask for help. And so to me, my experience of being answered in my prayers and my experience of seeing the complexity of the universe convinces me that there's a creator involved and that he could still be active in our own lives.
We're talking astronaut Tom Jones. When we come back, we're going to ask him to talk more about the infinite vastness of our universe, which is 4.5 billion years old. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible. Of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible. And we're talking to astronaut Tom Jones, who's a scientist, author, pilot, veteran NASA astronaut, who flew four space missions and led three spacewalks to install the centerpiece of the International Space Station, the American Destiny Laboratory. Tom, universe 4.5 billion years old. Tell us
How big is it?
I don't think the human mind can comprehend how big the universe is. You know, our solar system, as you mentioned, is 4.5 billion years old. That's the birth of the sun up until today. And of course, the planets were born shortly after the sun ignited at the center of the solar nebula 4.6 billion years ago. You've actually can hold a rock in your hand called a meteorite that dates back to the formation of the solar system. I think that's remarkable that we humans can hold a piece of the star stuff that our planet and our bodies and our minds are all made of. So that's remarkable. But, you know, our solar system is just a latecomer. And the Hubble telescope has helped us learn that the age of the universe is about 13.8 billion years in duration. And of course, ever since the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, the universe has been flying apart from that initial explosion. And we see these hundreds of billions of galaxies out there all getting farther apart from each other. And it looks like that in this particular universe, you know, those things are not going to all come hurtling back together. So it's just a continuously expanding universe with a lot of lifetime left ahead of it. But eventually it's just going to peter out into cold darkness. But that's tens of billions of years in the future. It's not something that we humans have to worry about. So just to comprehend that kind of age, that kind of distance, I think the most distant galaxy that we've been able to detect is something like 15 or more billion years, a billion light years away from us. That's something that the human mind can't comprehend. It's just numbers on a page. But what we can be sure of is that we are just a tiny little dust mote in the realm of this universe. And it would really surprise me if we would find that there's no other intelligent life out there. I certainly think that we're going to find other forms of life in our own solar system, on Mars perhaps, or around the moons, or in the moons of Jupiter or Saturn. There may be life around other stars in our Milky Way galaxy, these exoplanets that we've been discovering by the hundreds of late. But to me, it's absolutely statistically a positive in my view that there's life out there. And I think in my lifetime, we'll probably hear the first signals by laser or by radio wave from some other intelligent civilization.
Let's jump to 2030. The Baltimore Orioles win the World Series again, so you're happy? Give us a picture of space exploration in 2030.
2030, 10 years from now or so, I believe that Americans will be back on the moon permanently as part of a lunar outpost that's being established there at the South Pole of the moon, and we'll be there with our international partners, like on the space station. We'll have the Japanese, the Europeans, the Canadians. I hope the Russians will come along as well. And we'll be using that base on the pole of the moon to extract water, rocket fuel, eventually from the water supplies on the moon, and also exploring the history and the opportunities offered by the commercial minerals and energy that's available on the moon. So I think the moon is a way to expand our economy and our knowledge at the same time. And then by 2030, we'll certainly have another generation of rovers on Mars. They will have sent back samples from the Martian surface for us to examine in terrestrial labs here. And probably 10 years or so after 2030, we'll be ready to take the first human footsteps on Mars. And at the same time, the commercial space industry will have been exploding. And so we'll have, by 2030, a hotel in space, independent research laboratories in space that have been paid for privately. We'll have a variety of space vehicles that can take people on short tourist trips into orbit. And maybe even, as I said, for a week-long stay at a space hotel, maybe even perhaps on a voyage around the moon for some very wealthy individuals. But the competition, the advances in technology will bring the cost of all of that down. So I say, you know, 2030, we won't be sending too many people into space who are not millionaires at that point. But another generation later, people will be able to go on a long planned vacation into space and really enjoy it, like you would on a cruise to Antarctica today.
We're talking to astronaut Tom Jones. Amongst other things, he's an asteroid scientist. Talk to us about asteroids.
Well, they fascinate me because they're a chunk of the stuff that the planet Earth and its fellow planets are made of. So they're leftovers from the formation of the planets back 4.5 billion years ago. So I love holding a meteorite in my hand, a chunk of an asteroid that's fallen on Earth. And now this year, just in the past year, we've seen two spacecraft sample asteroids, Ryugu and Bennu, Japanese and American space probe. They're both going to be bringing their samples back to Earth. In fact, the Japanese ones landed back on Earth in December. So we're getting chunks of asteroids in space now to analyze and compare to our meteorites on the ground. And of course, asteroids not only brought raw materials and maybe even the ingredients of life to Earth when the Earth was born, but even today, they can change the course of life on our planet. And Earth has been bombarded throughout its history by asteroids sent careening into the Earth by the gravity of Jupiter acting in the asteroid belt. So we as humans now have the chance in the 21st century to actually stop the collision process of asteroids striking the Earth. And instead of going the way of the dinosaurs, which we would inevitably do if we did nothing with our knowledge, we now have the skills, both the knowledge about asteroids and the space skills, to stop a future collision with Earth. And this is something I do volunteering with the Association of Space Explorers, the Astronauts Professional Society, is to help the international efforts to find and then divert harmful asteroids. And I think, again, in the next generation, we'll have seen cooperating nations around the world reach out and stop a rogue asteroid from striking the Earth. We're going to get hit in the future, positively, 100% probability, but we have the skills to prevent that natural disaster from occurring. It's just a great benefit from our space program.
We're talking to astronaut Tom Jones, the author of 7 books and also a motivational speaker. One of your speeches is about success and mental preparation.
Yes, there's no substitute for getting ready and studying hard and preparing for a task in front of you. And for all of the astronauts, you know, we have the benefit of these wonderful teachers that NASA hires and teaches the astronaut crews all the skills they need to know to survive and to succeed in space. But that's only part of the job. You know, they can teach you everything that they know, but you have to be receptive on your side. You have to put in the hours to study. You have to get yourself in the right mental frame of mind so that you're committed to being a good teammate as well as being a successful operator yourself up there. So, you know, my formula for success is study hard, work hard, learn everything you can do to help your teammates, and then persevere. Don't give up the first time you fail. I have failed in space. I have failed getting ready for space. I have failed on the way to being a pilot. I've failed on the way to being a scientist. But each time you fail, you learn from that experience. Someone will help you. Your crewmates, your teammates will help you get up and start to contribute again. And just because of a failure, you should never give up. You should persist, be determined, be stubborn. And that's the formula for long-term success, in my view.
Astronaut Tom Jones, you're a modern-day Renaissance man. Thanks for all you do. Stay humble. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Stay healthy, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahol.
Believe in yourself.